The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Stephanie Ann Goldberg is a writer for magazines such as The Smart Set. Her husband, Morgan Meese, has a PhD in philosophy and is a recipient of the Whiting Award. Together, their book, Dead People, a collection of literary and critical obituaries, is due out from Zero Books in June of this year. It's Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. As this week's episode is about remembering and attempting to understand the significance of the dead, it seems appropriate here at the start to offer up a short excerpt from Hegel's Phenomenology. The dead individual, by his having detached and liberated his being from his action or his negative unity, is an empty particular, merely existing passively for some other, at the mercy of every lower irrational organic agency. His family keeps away from the dead this dishonoring of him by the desires of unconscious organic agencies, and by abstract elements puts its own action in place of theirs, and weds the relative to the bosom of the earth. Thereby the family makes the dead a member of a community, which prevails over and holds under control the powers of the particular material elements and the lower living creatures, which sought to have their way with the dead and destroy him. In this episode, you'll hear from Thomas J.J. Altizer on Hegel and the Death of God, a clip from Gene Martin and Reverend A.A. Allen and the gospel hymn, God's Not Dead, a bit of dialogue from the television show True Detective, and a clip from the documentary film, Manufacturing Consent. Right now, you're listening to Dan Letts, Yeah, It's All Right. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Stephanie Ann Goldberg and Morgan Meese discuss dead people. All right, so Stephanie Ann Goldberg is a writer, multimedia artist, and a founding member of Flux Factory, an arts collective in New York. She was a writer for the Smart Set magazine and the critic in residence at Drexel University from 2009. And she's written for the Washington Post, Lapham's Quarterly, and the New England Review, among other publications. Whereas Morgan Meese has a PhD in philosophy and is a founding member of the Flux Factory, an arts collective in New York. He has written for The New Yorker, N Plus One, The Believer, Harper's Magazine, Image Journal, and the Virginia Quarterly Review. He won the Whiting Award of 2013 and is the editor and editor at Three Quarks Daily and a winner of the Creative Capital Warhol Foundation's Arts Writers Grant. Congratulations. Morgan Meese, welcome to the Zero Books Podcast. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you
for having us.
So you wrote a book together, this book, Dead People, and it's due out from Zero Books in June. How did you come to write this collection of literary obituaries? Morgan, I'll start with you.
You know, there's a sort of honest, maybe somewhat disappointing answer, which is that when you're writing frequently for various editors, sometimes you're trying to figure out something to pitch and there's nothing out there. And then someone dies and you have that somewhat horrible moment. You're like, thank God, an interesting person died. And now I can think about it. And, you know, but I think the other thing that happened is it happened to us enough times that we started to kind of talk about it, that it becomes an interesting way to reflect on contemporary culture, to reflect on someone who, you know, a lot of these different people, you know, maybe they played an important role in visual art, or there's someone that, you know, conversation goes around those people in terms of politics, or, you know, whatever it is. And all of a sudden, it started to seem like an interesting way to kind of do cultural criticism, literary criticism, contemplative essay writing, you know, kind of a lot of different interesting things sort of come together. And you know, we talked about it a little bit more together too, and realized we just sort of liked that way, liked writing around this way of a kind of eulogistic type essay. Like, maybe it's its own little mini form that nobody really realized has all this potential to it, or something like that.
Okay. So Stephanie, you're going to sign off on that answer as to...
Yeah, I fully endorse that answer. That was quite well done, Morgan Means.
All right. So I want to ask you both, and maybe Stephanie, you can answer first. This is a maybe kind of a personal question, but are you both just professional journalists and writers? Is that what you do for a living?
Well, living is quite strong, but
that's a bold term for it.
We try to keep potatoes in the oven. Yeah, I think of myself. I don't think of myself as a journalist. I do think of myself as a person who writes. I am also an artist. I make short films and music, and so I dabble in a lot of things. Yeah, in terms of money, I would say. Yeah, I'm very, very lucky at this point in my life that I'm...
You've got a great... I mean, both of you together have a great list of creds, you know, like The New Yorker, The Smart Set, The Washington Post, New England Review, Harper's Magazine.
So that sounds kind of good. When you were reading off, I was like, that sounds all right. I don't sound like such the loser I feel.
No, it's really impressive. But it's a kind of... I know... what it's like. It's a hand-to-mouth existence, sort of. But I have to ask, neither of you have been seduced by the university system, and neither of you are looking to get into being professors anywhere?
Has anybody offered us a job?
Yeah, seduce us. I have done a little. I was teaching at Drexel University when we were outside of Philly a bit, and then at Moore College of Art and Design, but always on a, you know, semester to semester sort of adjunct status. I don't know. When I finished my PhD, I felt like I love academia in one sense, but I want to keep a distance from it at the same time. You know, not that you can't have a great intellectual life as an academic, not that academics, you know, true academics, maybe I just realize I personally am not a true academic. I'm not, you know, I want to be able to write to a more general audience, first of all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some distance, I think, for me is necessary.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay. So why don't we focus on the book for a bit, and then I'll come back to grilling you about your financial status and your prospects.
Send you over our tax return.
You'll be horrified.
So focusing in on the obits, these eulogies, these pieces, I thought we might discuss two people, Vaclav Havel and Christopher Hitchens. So starting with Vaclav Havel, Stephanie, you wrote that the problem of creating real and lasting societal change was a moral dilemma for Havel.
When I was rereading this essay, when we were getting the book together, I realized that that this essay kind of comes off in a way of me sort of reframing Havel, because Havel really, for me personally, but I know for a lot of people, was a kind of, you know, public intellectual left icon. You know, as an artist and as a, you know, political dissident. And I realized that I myself really misunderstood Havel's work when I first started reading it. This is sort of a bit of a longer answer to your question, but, you know, I started reading Havel probably, I went when I was, the summer I turned 21, I went to Prague to study. Mm-hmm. So I think I probably first started, you know, really reading his work then. And I'll tell you, I don't know about other people, but when I was 21, this is where I was at. I had a lot of anger. I didn't like authority figures very much. I felt that growing up in America felt to me like a big ruse. I didn't understand. I felt like I was desperately searching for real meaning and was not finding it really anywhere. And a writer like Havel really spoke to me with his absurdist plays because that's, in a way, that's just sort of how I felt. I felt like I was living sometimes in an absurdist play where everybody was giving me doublespeak and running around. And so I think that when I read Havel's plays, I understood his work to really be a critique of communism, of societies, you know, maybe even secretly of capitalism. Mm-hmm. But when Havel died, I realized right away that I wanted to write something about him, but I didn't exactly know what. And I just reread a lot of his nonfiction. What I realized is that Havel's work is not a critique of capitalism or a critique of societies in general. His work is a critique of modern condition. That Havel felt very much that modern human beings had become very, very lost, very morally lost, and I would say also very spiritually lost, in that we were trying, all of us, trying to put human beings as sort of at the center of the universe. And that this is what the problem was in communist Czechoslovakia, in other industrial, you know, Western societies, wherever. It didn't really matter. So that's basically what Havel was getting at, is that this is not, you know, I would say bringing it back to myself, like, I think for Havel, there's this difference between one thing between, you know, what is the difference between real, true unity among human beings and totalitarianism? And I think, you know, when I was 21, first reading Havel, and I had all this anger and I was sort of pointing my finger at those are the bad guys. Those are the people in power. I'm the powerless one. And it's all those guys is, you know, false. Basically, what Havel would say is I'm more on the side of totalitarianism than real unity, because I'm seeing all of my fellow human beings as outside of myself rather than looking to myself at how I can be, you know, a sort of a source of unity in the world. So that's my very long answer to your question.
That's really interesting. There's a lot to unpack there. I kind of am struggling myself even now at the age of 45 and, you know, far too many years away from 21, with this problem of meaning, which I think is at the heart of what you're saying Havel was struggling for, as opposed to the problem of justice. So, like, looking for a good society, a good way to organize, you know, our interactions, our legal system, our economic system, whatever you want, that's the problem of justice. And then the other problem is the problem of meaning. And in a world that's sort of secular, in which the old relations based on religion have been replaced by modern capitalist relations, finding meaning is just as difficult as finding justice. And they almost seem to be at odds with each other. It's like, you know, there, I guess there's this religious impulse when you struggle for meaning. And that religious impulse is somewhat irrational, and it doesn't necessarily care about equality or, you know, cares about paternity, but only in so much as you are united together around a religious object, whether it's God or Buddha or, you know, whatever. And so I wonder if you saw in Havel a similar struggle.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. But I would say probably, and I am not an expert on Václav Havel either. But I would say that I think for Havel, meaning came first in a way that I think Havel was quite suspicious of political institutions, or I wouldn't even say political, just institutions in general that we human beings create to fix our problems. You know what I mean? Like, we have a bunch of problems, and then so we create institutions, and we want the institutions to sort of fix us.
Mm-hmm.
But what Havel was sort of hoping for, or writing about, or advocating, I think, is that we have to start with the meaning first, with ourselves first. And that institutions, in a way, that sort of grow out of people who already have some meaning in their lives, rather than looking to the institution to give us meaning. That we, on the other hand, if we start with ourselves, we are creating meaningful institutions.
Why do you say that we need to, if we're looking for meaning, we have to start with ourselves rather than start with, you know, well, God, say? Why would we, isn't that already kind of a secular move, a post-Enlightenment move to say, okay, if we're going to find meaning, we're going to find it with the human individual?
Yeah, that's a really fantastic question. I guess what I mean by starting with ourselves is it's good that you brought up the word God, because Václav Havel believed in God. He was not an atheist, and actually towards the very end of his life was pretty critical of atheism. So I would say, just what I mean by looking for meaning within ourselves, not looking for meaning, I don't mean necessarily me on my own. I'm looking for meaning in 70, but really my relationship, you could say my relationship to God, God being me being God, your God, Morgan being God, all of us having this connection.
So the place to start is getting right with Jesus then. I mean, just, you know, maybe broadly. And then you can work on changing the world. I mean, you know, you end up in that position. No one really wants to embrace that position anymore, right? I mean, no one who's writing for The New Yorker or The Smart Set wants to embrace that position. But it's there.
Well, I wouldn't say that nobody writing for The New Yorker or The Smart Set wants to embrace that position.
Okay,
so.
Maybe you do. Go ahead.
Blake's self-annihilation of God fully correlates with Hegel's absolute self-negation. Both are purely and comprehensively kenotic or self-emptying movements, and both are genuinely and fully apocalyptic movements, thereby recovering a lost and original apocalyptic Christianity. And just as Blake enacts a total imaginative vision, comprehending everything to which it could possibly be open, Hegel's is the only true.
Yeah. Here's Brother Gene Martin, the Miracle Valley Choir, to sing praise to him, to find his name, friend.
Yeah.
rather than other people, looking at it, let's say the 21-year-old version of myself, I felt like everything was up to me. Like I was, you know, Václav Havel said this thing that a problem with human beings is that we all think that we're God. So that we all think that everything is absolutely and totally and completely up to us. And what this does, again, is this actually doesn't bring us together. It separates us rather than seeing, you know, when you know, I mean, God, what do we mean by God? And, you know, in a way, I think it's, you know, for the purpose of this, I think Havel would be satisfied to think of, you know, in our discussion, God as that unity itself.
What unity?
The unity of the universe, of us, of this trend, you know, something that is outside of just a puny human being. I mean, it's so for me, I feel like it was, I feel like I personally, thinking that I think that I do as a human being, I have a lot of responsibility, but I think I have very little power, I guess is what I'm saying, yeah. Just completely and totally on my own.
I have this perspective, I guess it's from Durkheim. Mm-hmm. I tend to view religious history as a history of the way that human beings have organized their social lives rather than truly about a relationship with some transcendent power.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about unity, I think what you're talking about is fitting into a social order. That struggle for meaning turns around and becomes a struggle for the right way to live with other people, and which becomes about justice. And, you know, you sort of you're unavoidably brought back to institutions. The problem is we don't feel confident about standing on our own 2 feet. We need to refer to something transcendent in order to justify our relations because we are very bad at making them perfect. In fact, that seems to be impossible. So inequality is sort of built into all human relations, to life. But so we have to justify these instances of inequality or imperfection. And that's where we turn to some sort of transcendent notion. But see, once you say that, then you've robbed yourself of the transcendent notion. That's the modern condition. The modern condition is the death of God. It's the loss of God. And that we can argue that we need God, but we can't argue very persuasively that there is that for God as existing or as a force in the world. But maybe I'm wrong. Do you think Havel felt that there was a strong argument for, I hate to say like the existence of God, but that's the only way I can think of saying it.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if what Havel would advocate for was a kind of, are you asking like for proof of God?
Well, that's what I'm, yeah. Okay. First of all, would Havel think that we needed a proof of God? And the thing about those are, whenever they're put forward, they're abstract and sort of thin. Even if they're persuasive, you know, logically, they're not necessarily viscerally persuasive. Like, you know, you go through the philosophical arguments, like the ontological argument for God's existence, which isn't the best argument, but it's the one that comes to mind right now. And you can say you might be convinced by it, but it's hardly a great place to start the foundation of a real faith,
mm-hmm.
You know. And it seems like to me that the place to start the foundation of a real faith is already a kind of communal lived experience of faith.
Yeah. Well, I think that I agree with. You know, when you were talking just now, I had this something that Havel said. Maybe it's even in my essay as well about something about like ancient peoples used to just look up at the stars and feel just the deep mystery of them. And there's something about that deep mystery of just looking up at the stars all together, you know, the experience of feeling smaller than them, but also just not knowing, feeling like completely amazed. And that modern, I think Havel, it's not necessarily, I think that Havel was saying that modern people are not capable of looking up at the stars with a sense of awe and wonder anymore. Mm-hmm. But there's something about the way it's almost impossible for us now to look up at the stars. And, you know, if we have any knowledge about, you know, science in any way, shape or form, or knowledge, or even knowledge of, you know, what stars are made out of, or that we're also looking at that as well. And that I don't think, you know, it's easy to hear something like that and think like, well, Havel is just some sort of like anti-technology or anti-knowledge or anti, you know, it's not true. Havel himself was a modern person, but something about the, I think that Havel felt that there was actually something that was lost about this, you know, in that loss, there was something lost in that experience of being able to look up at the stars and just feel like in complete and total awe and mystery. And I think that that's that difference between, it's not a proof of something bigger. It's not necessarily about proof. It is much more, I think, I'm hoping that this is what you're getting at, about the experience and the experience of how a group of people looking up the stars in like complete and total mystery and smallness can actually bring them together and give them meaning in a very specific way that knowledge about the stars does not necessarily. Again, I think this is what Havel was getting at.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what I'm getting at exactly. I'm just sort of questioning you, you know, seeing if maybe I can get you to tell me what the truth of life is. But I have a feeling that maybe we're going to end up somewhere a little bit short of that. But, okay, one thing that you mentioned was being 21 and feeling angry and disaffected and alienated from maybe your fellow students or from your family. You didn't say. But I remember being – a little younger, like 20, I think, and having a very specific experience of alienation from my family, and then also by extension from the whole society. And it was stupid. I was visiting my aunt and uncle with my parents in the summer between my freshman and sophomore year of college, and they were all arguing about which movie to watch and what restaurant to go to after. And I thought to myself, how can we make sense of our lives when we can't make sense of the next 30 minutes, you know? And they all they all decided, they all came together around watching Pretty Woman, which was like, I thought, the worst decision. You know, we'd all seen it for one thing, and it wasn't a very good movie. And so I went upstairs, and I don't know, I read Sartre or something. I don't remember what I did exactly, but
that would be the proper.
And what led you to feel this sort of anger when you were 21?
Oh, goodness. That's a big question. You know, I just think that beyond all of the, you know, different things growing up, you know, I was born and raised in Las Vegas, which is not exactly, for me, it was not a good place for, you know, I guess a thinking person. I was a pretty sensitive person. I didn't find a lot of other people that I connected to, including adults. Mm-hmm. I think that, honestly, you know, beyond all of the external things, I just knew. I knew that there was, and I think maybe you were getting this too, like, I just felt in my heart that there was something more than this life of getting up, you know, going to school, doing this, doing my homework, you know, then get a good job and try to do this and try to fit into society and, you know, that there was, it's not, you know, not even that going to school or having actual job that pays you is, there's anything wrong with that. But why do all of that? That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah.
What's motivating me in this life?
Yeah, this is what I felt in that moment. It was not just that they couldn't decide on what movie to go to or what to do, but it was that the choices were all so paltry and stupid, and that there was no chance of maybe doing something meaningful in that moment. We'd already been set into these patterns of decisions that would be sure to make – basically, the main thing was we wouldn't be talking to each other about what was going on with each other, what we thought about each other, what we thought about ourselves, what was going on in our lives overall. All of that was kind of off the table. But it wasn't like a conscious choice anyone was making. It was just how things were working out. And I thought none of these people have any control over their own social interactions or who they are. I mean, I didn't think that clearly, but I think that was my response to this, you know, in my kind of just after teenage way of rebelling. I thought, you people are all idiots. Havels is something that says each person is capable to a greater or lesser degree of coming to terms with living within the lie. And I'm wondering, do you think the lie is the kind of lie that we're telling ourselves where we end up watching Pretty Woman, or is it something else?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I'm so happy that you brought up this experience of yours, because basically what you just explained is like you just wrote a Václav Havel play. I mean, that is it. That is completely it. It's a group of people sitting around and living within that absence of meaning. What do you fill it with? Right? Everybody, including you, but not just you. You were maybe more aware that there was something else, but every single person that you were with was, Havel would say, was having the same experience of an absence of meaning and desperately trying to figure out how to fill that hole. And that is what absurdism was for Havel. It wasn't, you know, this thing overlying, you know, which I used to think it was, it's sort of like absurd, like, oh, everything is so absurd, like a sort of nihilist thing. He said, like, having that experience of absurdity, that is life. It's becoming aware of it, it's sort of the next step, right?
Mm-hmm.
Becoming aware of that. So if what Havel means by that we are all, you, me, Morgan, every single person is capable of, because of the fact as modern people, that we're all experiencing that same and susceptible to that same absence of meaning, that same hole in our lives. And therefore, every single one of us is capable of filling that void with lies, with danger, with hate, with totalitarianism, with what, you know, with A Pretty Woman, though Pretty Woman's a pretty entertaining movie, but you know what I mean? Like with anything, with, you know, with the being addicted to intellectualism, with being addicted to alcohol, with everything, what can happen is that, you know, we can become, I think Havel would say, like, we can become aware of this absence of meaning once we have experienced it, once we've really, you know, really, really have gone to the depths of it. I mean, I feel like in some ways, Havel and some of his writing seems like there's almost some of us hit an absurdist bottom where we just can't take it anymore. We just know that there's just something that absurdity just won't do anymore. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, but then there's like this whole, again, there's this whole world. Like what do we fill it with? For Havel, anything that has to do just with first and foremost, you know, human stuff is not ultimately going to work, but that's him.
I think human consciousness was a tragic misstep in evolution. We became too self-aware. Nature created an aspect of nature separate from itself. We are creatures that should not exist by natural law.
Well, that sounds god-fucking-awful, Rush.
We are things that labor under the illusion of having a self, this accretion of sensory experience and feeling, programmed with total assurance that we are each somebody, when in fact everybody's nobody.
I wouldn't go around spouting that shit. I was you. People around here don't think that way.
Okay, so now I want to turn to Morgan and talk about Christopher Hitchens. You describe in your essay meeting Christopher Hitchens, who I think would be maybe the opposite of everything we've been talking about up to now, because he's such a committed atheist. But what was the context of that encounter?
The literal context was that it was just a Harper's Magazine Christmas party. And he happened to be there, you know, mostly, I think, for the free booze and discussion in that order. And a friend of mine, a very close friend, Stephen Levine, also known as the Adorable Rabbi, who is now a philosophy professor at UMass. We were still working, I think, on our dissertations at that time, and had written a little review, kind of more of a thought. It was, Hitchens had just come out with that little book, letter. Is it Letter to a Young Contrarian?
Yeah.
There was that series of letters to so-and-so. This is some years ago. So
Letters to a Young Contrarian was the book that you reviewed.
Right. So we reviewed this book. And in reviewing this book, we kind of were trying to figure out where Hitchens was at that moment. You know, this is when just after he'd had his big break with the left. And, you know, there were a lot of discussions in New York leftist circles about what this all means and where Hitchens is. And I think in some ways it caused everybody to sort of, let's say it caused everybody I knew to look inside a little bit too and figure out where we were and what was going on with this whole discussion. And so we wrote this piece that was kind of an attempt to figure some of this stuff out through this funny little book he'd written. And so at this Harper's Christmas party, I waited in the line. You know, at that point you had to sort of pay court to Hitchens. You had to wait in a line to go up to him and talk to him. You know, and I'm sort of holding this, it was a issue of a magazine called Radical Society. So I had my little issue of Radical Society, and I'm waiting there to, you know, give it to him and get his response. And then we talked. I got to talk to him for a few minutes. But there was a young lady behind me in a very tight red dress, so I didn't get that much time with him
right
to discuss it at that moment. But then we had a sort of email back and forth about it and some other things. So it created a little bit of a discussion kind of about the intellectual question of the day at that time.
Had he already read your piece before you got to the
No. So this was giving it to him, and then we had a little talk because he asked, "Well, what is this?" And I tried to give him, I forget now exactly what my 5-sentence explanation was, but he was interested. He was intrigued. And then that led to a later discussion that we had via email and a couple of other meetings before he died.
What was the main thrust of your critique of his book, Letters to a Young Contrarian? Can you sum that up? Or I know you said you couldn't really remember what you told him, but can you make up a new set of 5 sentences?
To my recollection, it was something around this issue. Somewhere in that little pamphlet, he made a claim about what the limits of human beings might be, biological limits, let's say, that prevent us from maybe being the creatures that we sort of hope we should be. And my friend Stephen and I had found an earlier passage, and I think he used a quote from someone to maybe from a biologist or something like that, to sort of, or a neuroscientist or something like that. And we found a quote from an earlier Hitchens where he sort of repudiated this kind of point and said that in some sense, being a socialist means not putting those kinds of limits on your sense of what human beings are capable, and therefore what human society is capable of being, what human communities can be.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a sort of open-ended approach when he identified himself more as a democratic socialist. And then all of a sudden, this idea of limits and biological limits and that human beings just can't, not that much can be expected of them in this Young Contrarians book. Mm-hmm. And we try to dive into that as maybe the source or also kind of justification for why he felt he could jettison this particular identity of being a democratic socialist and kind of take his turn to what he was. I don't think he ever described himself as having a specific politics so much after that, but certainly of being a kind of sick of the left, tired of his leftist stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember how much he would write about how he was liberated from this feeling that he had to parrot this democratic socialist kind of lingo that he didn't really believe in anymore. And then we felt like, well, here's the philosophical core of it. He no longer believes that human beings are even capable of that anymore.
You know, what's really interesting to me about that is that I recall at the time that he wrote an attack on Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
That was sort of one of the ways he broke with the left. And what's fascinating about Chomsky is that he holds the same view that Hitchens took up as an excuse to leave the left. That Chomsky is very adamant about there being biological limits to what human beings are capable of and limits to reason. His whole project as a linguist is to kind of discover what those limits are. And,
yeah, no, it's a good point.
So the realization of those limits, that there are those biological limits, doesn't automatically tell you that the world that you're in and the society that you're in is the best world there could possibly be. Obviously, Chomsky doesn't believe that, but he does believe in biological limits.
That's a very good point. And I think you're right. They're both, or Hitchens, let's say, became more of a biological determinist in those ways. And Chomsky always was one, at least around linguistic.
Yeah.
At least on the linguistic side.
Which, by the way, that extends to the possibilities of human understanding, which would ultimately lead to some sort of thought that there was a limit to what the kinds of social structures, the kinds of political institutions that will ever work for human beings.
Yeah, which maybe makes Chomsky into something like a sort of a tragic theorist or something, a theorist of the tragic condition or something there. But Chomsky seems comfortable in that place, that somehow reason's able to show us how badly we fail to live up to what we can otherwise see are perfectly reasonable and rational ways that we could organize ourselves in a human society that would be good, but somehow we're also so tragically incapable of doing that. And he seems to be comfortable being the kind of prophet who sits between those two things, pointing out the terrible situation over and over and over again. Well, and I think that was that's the thing that was intolerable to Hitchens. Hitchens's point, I think, was that if that's what you're telling me, I'm out. I don't want it. I want to fight. Like, I want to fight, literally want to fight for something good and believe that it can be, you know. And so I wonder if in some ways Hitchens was like, I don't know if we can make anything good anymore, but at least we can know who the bad guys are. Yeah. And kick their asses as much as possible.
Right.
And at least then I feel like I'm doing something worthwhile. Sure. Whereas Chomsky just is happy to be in this position of almost nothing's possible, but you have to keep showing it anyway.
No. But see, the thing about Chomsky, what's great about him is that he says, look, when it comes to what our understanding is, we have almost enough understanding to grasp the way insects organize themselves. Not even quite enough. So when it comes to understanding what the limits of human societies are and what we're capable of, we are so far away from having any sort of reasonable, rational understanding of that, that what we have to turn to when it comes to political struggle are basically truisms. No one has the truth. So, you know, it's more about morality and going with what is most just from the perspective of sort of everyday common sense. He just doesn't think of his philosophical or linguistic theories as having any way of informing his politics.
If, in fact, our minds were a blank slate and experience wrote on them, we would be very impoverished creatures indeed. So the obvious hypothesis is that our language is the result of the unfolding of a genetically determined program. Well, plainly, there are different languages. In fact, the apparent variation of languages is quite superficial. It's certain, as certain as anything else, is that humans are not genetically programmed to learn one or another language. So you bring up a Japanese baby in Boston, it'll speak Boston English. And you bring up my child in Japan, it'll speak Japanese. And that means that it simply follows by logic that the basic structure of the languages must be essentially the same. Our task as scientists is to try to determine exactly what those fundamental principles are that cause the knowledge of language to unfold in the manner in which it does under particular circumstances. And incidentally, I think there is no doubt the same must be true of other aspects of human intelligence and systems of understanding and interpretation and moral and aesthetic judgment and so on.
The implications of these views have washed over the fields of psychology, education, sociology, philosophy, literary criticism, and logic.
In the 50s and 60s, the bridge between your theoretical work and your political work seems to have been the attack on behaviorism. But now, behaviorism is no longer an issue, or so it seems. So how does this leave the link between your linguistics and your politics?
Well, I've always regarded the link... I've never really perceived much of a link, to tell you the truth. Again, I would be very pleased to be able to discover intellectually convincing connections between my own anarchist convictions on the one hand and what I think I can demonstrate or at least begin to see about the nature of human intelligence on the other. But I simply can't find intellectually satisfying connections between those two domains.
Yeah, I mean, it must be back there somewhere informing his ability to make correct criticisms, right? How does he know that his, you know, that his critique of the way the defense industry funds wars around the world and how the culture and industry justifies that and all those sorts of things. I mean, where does truth come out?
He has no problem understanding the empirical data of what's actually happening. The question is, how do we set up a society that would allow that to stop happening?
Right. So that's what I mean by being kind of trapped between the one thing you have enough, right. You have enough there from our critical apparatus, from our tools of reason to see how bad it is.
Right.
That's just about it.
Yeah, that's right.
And you could say that's a pretty screwed up spot to be in. It's hard. It's painful. Right. It's unpleasant, you know, and it requires an immense amount of kind of patience. I guess you have to say maybe from an evolutionary biological perspective, you know, maybe you're setting groundwork that thousands of years from now can play itself out or something like that.
I guess.
If nothing else, Hitchens just didn't have that kind of patience.
Right.
You know? He had the patience of a 3-month child, I think. You know? Right. And so, you know, it was now kind of thing for Hitchens, which I can understand too. I mean, I feel for that. I was seduced by that myself, I should say, for a time too.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of Paul Berman, I don't know if you remember that Paul Berman piece about sort of banging on the table and saying, you know, what happened to the fight against fascism? The fascists aren't right now, the real fascists, the fascists torturing people are the Ba'athists in Iraq, you know? Where are we in that fight? That fight is right now, and there's a difference there. You know, that sort of hit me hard for a time there, and I didn't want to feel like I just had to sit that fight out and be on the sidelines for it and sit around in the sort of tragic situation of the Chomskyists saying, well, wait a second though, you know, the big thing to think about here is American imperialism, which in the big story has much much greater power. You know, but what about these fascists right now killing Kurds? You know, what about that? Like, that's, you know, that's something that's actually right here and now. I don't have to wait 5,000 years for human beings to develop a better cerebral cortex.
But the quote that really gets to me from your piece is, he says, the real fight is with me. The good fight is with me. what he's really saying is, I think what I'm about is furthering my own, I don't know what, pleasure, career, sense of justice. I'm not sure what, but exercising my own individual power. Was that what it was? What did he mean by the good fight and the real fight is with me?
I took that to mean he meant like I'm on the side. You're missing. You're on the wrong side. You guys out there, you leftists,
okay,
who are fighting the Bush regime and think the real fight's with me over here with me and the few of us who are saying, no, that's not actually the enemy at hand right now. I don't think he meant like, but you're right. I think in a deeper sense, though, you're right that there's something so deeply ego driven in Hitchens' thing that ultimately it was about for him being on the right side of history and about him proving to everyone else that he was right. I mean, the sense of I'm right and I'll be proven right in the end was, I mean,
that was the most important thing.
It was the most important thing, it seemed, a lot of the time. So yeah, I think you're right. But I do think just in terms of just the, I think it was just a not super well stated thing about saying, you know, come over to my side of the fight, my side of right. the fight, the right,
right.
side.
Right. But the way to do that is not just to say it. It's the way to really, you know, supposedly by intellectuals should be making arguments rather than saying, I hear what you're saying and let me refute what you're saying. He's just said, nah, me, my fight. We're on the
right
side.
Well, he was always a seducer too, yeah. right? So the seducer side of him, it always was very personal. It got very personal very quickly in all of these arguments.
You say that he was not truly a lover of reason, but a lover of persuasion and argument.
Yeah, I think so. I think reason was always a tool to be used, not a virtue in itself so much. And he was certainly more than willing to, I mean, when you look actually back at some of his arguments, some of them are terrible arguments actually,
yeah.
but he makes them so well. If you watch some of these debates he had with people back around the time of the Iraq War, he wins some of those debates hands down. The audience is with him. He's 10 times more charming. You want to listen to what he's saying. But if you stop back and actually dispassionately try to look at them, he's wrong a lot of the time, I think. He's
right.
completely wrong, and yet he wins hands down. So
that's how I felt about him at the time. I was, you know, involved in protesting not only the war in Iraq, but even the way we invaded Afghanistan. I thought mm-hmm. we should basically treat the attacks of September 11th as a criminal problem and go after the terrorist organizations separately from any state, trying to get cooperation. Anyway, I
think you were right about that, but I don't think there were very many of us who were clear-headed enough to be able to see that. And,
right.
and Hitchens certainly not.
Right. But I remember being so frustrated with Hitchens because he was so erudite and persuasive in his way. But when you would read him rather than listen to him, he was sometimes was ludicrous, you know, not just,
yeah.
So I at that time really hated Hitchens, like with a passion hated Hitchens. It's only now that I've come to kind of respect him again. Maybe it's because I'm older and more conservative. I don't know, he was a frustrating fellow. And so I just want to ask you, do you feel that reason is just a tool, or do you feel that reason isn't good in itself?
Yeah. I guess there's a deeper argument about reason here then too. I mean, even just thinking about Hitchens and how he used the passions and the way that reason played a role in that. I come from a sort of intellectual background. You know, I did my graduate work at the New School
mm-hmm.
for Social Research in New York City. And the, you know, at the philosophy department there, I think we were constantly doing work to say that reason isn't actually that thing that we pretend it is. Let's say, and I don't want to get into too much of technical academic-y discussion here, debates between analytic and continental philosophy and these sorts of things. But the idea that there is even something that is reason that's not always already caught up with how we feel, what we want, what our framework for understanding is. I don't know if you want to look at this in a Gadamerian standpoint, or, you know, or Heideggerian, or these other sorts of things. But we already have a position that we're committed to even before we start looking at the so-called objective facts. Another way to say that is there's no such thing as those objective facts. Mm-hmm. Though it's already messy. It's messy as hell right from the beginning. So I guess for me, the idea that we could even talk about reason as disassociated from the things, what do we want to say, the passions, emotion, feelings, all these other kinds of things, or let's say pre-rational commitments, I don't know, whatever language you want to use. So that's, you know, so that's one thing. That's maybe a root kind of philosophical position.
Right.
But then there is a misuse of reason too. Isn't there somewhere you can accept that and still say that there is a way in which we can still use the reason we have to be engaged in mutual interpretation, to have a kind of charity toward one another when we have dialogue, to not try to crush one another in the way that I think Hitchens often did, no matter what, you know, whatever it takes, whatever strategy to be employed. So there's a way, too, that I want to kind of maintain a sort of commitment to what you might call reason, but maybe it's more about having a genuine care and commitment and respect toward the other position, or the other human being, or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a satisfying...
Well, I'm more on the side of Hegel than Heidegger. So yeah. I tend to...
Well, what's the split? I would say Hegel and Heidegger are roughly on the same side with that. What's the distinction you want to make there?
Well, I think that Hegel felt that we could, in fact, deploy reason to know the world as it really was. And that even though we were situated historically, even though we were always going to be self-interested, that there was still a way to get to reason through subjectivity, that substance was subject and all this kind of stuff. I could go, you know, but I think of Heidegger as basically being a mystic. Maybe that I'm not being fair to him. I've read Hegel. I've only read about Heidegger. We'll put all that aside, because we can have another podcast someday where we debate Heidegger and Hegel. I want to get Stephanie back in. She's been, you know, you had to sit for 30 minutes of me talking to her. Now she had to sit through 30 minutes of me talking to you. I'll talk to both of you for a second here at the end, because we're coming up on an hour. So is this the first book of many that you plan on writing together, Stephanie?
Oh, I hope so. That would be fun. Morgan and I have a lot of ideas of books that we would like to write together.
Now, you lived together, right?
We're married.
Yeah, you're married. Okay. So this will be a long-term writing thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, are you committing zero books to a multi-volume contract here? You know, we've got it on tape now.
I didn't actually do that, but we'll see how this book goes. I would love to have more from you, actually. But I don't know about multi-volumes.
Very deadest people.
I think you guys are great. And what would you do next? Would you write? Do you want to write together again for your next project? In a way, this wasn't writing together, right? You guys wrote these pieces separately and then.
Well, I would say yes and no. These pieces were written. They were written separately, right? So it's not. They're all separate essays, and I think our names are underneath. Who, you know, you can see who wrote what.
But we work. We
work each other's.
I mean, these essays go back and forth between everything we write is a collaborative project, right. Really. So they were very collaboratively written in that sense.
You know, Morgan and I have actually, we've written a lot of non-published things together. And it's a very interesting process to write with, to really write with somebody else, right? Because writing is so, for me anyway, it's so solitary. But in a way that is sometimes beautiful and sometimes creepy, Morgan and I are capable of sharing our brains.
Well, when you say it's creepy, I hope it isn't science fictionally creepy or some sort of.
It's getting there. But
not quite.
Well, that's great. Well, you know, it's nice to hear that, that there are two writers who can work together, let alone a married couple. I just, I would find it, I think myself, I'd find it very frustrating to try to match my view to anyone else's. But, you guys seem to have done quite well. These pieces.
There were some rough spots when we first really started giving our work to each other and trying to do things more collaboratively and really allowing each other to, say truly honest things about, I mean, it was not an easy process.
Yeah.
But I think there was something wonderful about kind of, I feel grateful for having gone through that. It allowed me to kind of give up, surrender some of my preconceived notions about what I wanted my writing to be or sound like, and to really sort of open that up in a very interesting way, and to take criticism and take another person's input in a way that I really feel has been a benefit. So it was worth the pain in this case.
That's great. Well, is there anything I didn't ask either one of you that you wished I had, or is there anything that you want to say as we wrap this up?
I really thought your questions were excellent. I really do.
Well, that discussion, that sort of theological discussion you guys got into with Hava was really wonderful. I loved just sitting and listening to it. And your story, Douglas, about the pretty woman and all that
was awesome.
So, no, this was fun. I look forward. Anytime you want to do this, it's good.
Well, thank you. This is always what I like to hear at the end is compliments. So I appreciate it.